Chapter 7. St. Louis, July 1857. The fever dream lay up in St. Louis for 12 days. It was a busy time for the entire crew, but for Joshua York and his strange companions. Abner Marsh was up and about early every morning, and on the streets by 10, making calls on shippers and hotel proprietors, talking up his boat and trying to scare up business. He had a mess of handbills printed for Fever River packets, now that he had more than one packet again, and hired some boys to paste them up all over the city. Drinking and eating in all the best places, Marsh told and retold the story of how the fever dream took the Southerner, to make sure the word got around. He even took out advertisements in 3 of the local papers. The lightning pilots that Abner Marsh had hired for the lower river came aboard as soon as the fever dream put into St. Louis, and drew their wages for the time they'd idled away waiting. Pilots didn't come cheap, especially pilots like these two. But Marsh didn't begrudge the money too much, since he wanted the best for his steamer. Once paid, the new men resumed their idling. Pilots drew full wages all the time, but didn't do a lick of work until the steamer was in the river. Anything besides piloting was beneath their dignity. The two pilots Marsh had found had their own individual styles of idling, though. Dan Albright, prim and taciturn and fashionable, strolled aboard the day the fever dream put in, surveyed the boat, the engines and the pilot house, nodded with satisfaction and immediately took up residence in his cabin. He spent his days reading in the steamer's well-stocked library and played a few games of chess with Jonathan Jeffers in the main saloon, although Jeffers invariably beat him. Carl Fram, on the other hand, could usually be found in the billiard halls along the riverfront, grinning crookedly beneath his wide-brimmed felt hat and bragging about how him and his new boat were going to run everyone else off the river. Fram had a heller's reputation. He liked to joke about how he kept one wife in St. Louis, one in New Orleans, and a third in Natchez under the hill. Abner Marsh didn't have the time to worry over much about what his pilots were doing. He was too busy with this task or that one. Nor did he see much of Joshua York and his friends, although he understood that York frequently went on long nightly walks into the city, often with Simon, the silent one. Simon was also learning how to mix drinks, since Joshua had told Marsh he had a mind to use him as a night bartender on the run down to New Orleans. Marsh did frequently see his partner over supper, which Joshua York was in the habit of taking in the main cabin with the other officers, before he retired to his own cabin or the library to read newspapers, packets of which were delivered to him every day, fresh off incoming steamers. Once York announced that he was going into the city to see a group of players perform. He invited Abner Marsh and the other officers to accompany him, but Marsh was having none of it, so York wound up going with Jonathan Jeffers. "Poems and plays," Marsh muttered to Harry Mike Dunn as they sauntered off. "Makes you wonder what the damn river is coming to." Afterwards, Jeffers began to teach York to play chess. "He has quite a mind, Abner," Jeffers told Marsh a few days later on the morning of their 8th day in St. Louis.
"Who?"
"Why, Joshua, of course. I taught him the moves 2 days ago. Last night I found him in the saloon playing over the score of one of Murphy's games from one of those New York newspapers he takes. A strange man. How much do you know about him?" Marsh frowned. He didn't want his people getting too curious about Joshua York. That was part of the bargain.
"Joshua don't like to talk much about himself. I don't ask him. A man's past is none of my business, I figure. You ought to take the same attitude, Mr. Jeffers. In fact, see that you do."
The clerk arched his thin, dark eyebrows. "If you say so, Captain," he replied. But there was a cool smile on his face that Abner Marsh found disquieting. Jeffers was not the only one to ask questions. Harry Mike came to Marsh too, and said that the roustabouts and stokers were spreading some funny talk about York and his 4 guests, and did Marsh want him to do anything about it?
"What kind of talk?"
Harry Mike shrugged eloquently.
"About him only coming out at night.
About those queer friends of his, too. You know Tom who stokes the middle larboard? He's been telling this story. Says that night we left Louisville, well, you remember how thick the skeeters were. Well, Tom says he saw that old Simon down on the main deck, just kind of looking around, and a skeeter landed on his hand, and he went and swatted it with his other hand, squashed it. But you know how full up skeeters get sometimes. So when you squash them, they just bust with the blood. Tom says that happened with the skeeter on the back of Simon's hand, so it smeared up all bloody when he got it. Only then, Tom tells it, that Simon just kind of stared at his hand for the longest while, then lifted it up. And damned if he didn't lick it clean."
Abner Marsh scowled.
You tell your boy Tom that he better stop telling such stories, or he's going to be stoking the middle larboard on somebody else's steamer.
Hairy Mike nodded, brought his iron billet into his other hand with a meaty thwack, and turned to go. But Marsh stopped him.
No, he said. Wait. You tell him not to go spreading those stories. But if he sees anything funny, he should come to you or to me. Tell him we'll give him a half dollar.
He'd lie for the half dollar.
Well, forget the half dollar then, but you tell him the rest of it.
The more Abner thought about Tom's story, the more it bothered him. He was just as glad that Joshua York was going to install Simon as bartender, where he'd be out in public and the man could keep an eye on him. Marsh had never liked morticians, and Simon still reminded him of one something ungodly, when he didn't remind him of one of their patrons, that is. He only hoped that Simon didn't go licking up no mosquitoes while he was serving drinks to the cabin passengers. That kind of thing could ruin a boat's reputation awful fast. Marsh soon put the incident out of his mind and plunged back into business. On the night before their scheduled departure, however, something else bothered him. He had called on Joshua York in his cabin to go over a few details of their trip. York was sitting at his desk, with his slim, ivory-handled knife in hand, slicing an article out of a newspaper. He and Marsh chatted briefly for a few minutes about the business at hand, and Marsh was about to take his leave when he noticed a copy of the Democrat on York's desk.
"They were supposed to run one of our advertisements today," Marsh said, reaching for the paper. "You finished with this, Joshua?"
York dismissed the paper with a wave of his hand. "Take it if you'd like," he said. Abner Marsh carried the paper under his arm to the main cabin and paged through it while Simon made him a drink. He was annoyed. He couldn't locate their advertisement. Of course it might not be an omission. York had sliced out a story on the page that backed up the shipping news, so there was a hole just in the prime place. Marsh drained his glass, folded up the paper, and went forward to the clerk's office.
"You got the latest number of the Democrat?" Marsh asked Jeffers. "I think that damned Blair left out my advertisement."
"It's there yonder," Jeffers replied. "But he didn't. Look on the shipping page." And sure enough, there it was, a box smack in the middle of a column of similar boxes. Fever River Packet Company. "The splendid fleet steamer Fever Dream will leave for New Orleans, Louisiana, and all intermediate points and landings on Thursday, making the best time and manned by all experienced officers and crew. For freight or passage, apply on board or at the company office at the foot of Pine Street. Abner Marsh, President." Marsh inspected the advertisement, nodded and flipped back a page to see what Joshua York had cut out. The item looked to be a reprint lifted from some downriver paper about some old no-count woodyard man found dead in his cabin on the river north of New Madrid. The mate of a steamer that had put in for wood found him when no one answered their calls. Some thought that Indians did it, some others said wolves, since the body had been all ripped up and half-eaten. That was just about all it said. "Something wrong, Cap'n Marsh?" Jeffers asked. "You got a queer look on your face." Marsh folded up Jeffers' Democrat and stuck it under his arm with York's.
"No, nothing. Damn paper just spelled a couple of things wrong."
Jeffers smiled.
"Are you certain? I know spelling isn't your strong suit, Cap'n."
"Don't you go joshing me about that again, or I'll chuck you over the side, Mr. Jeffers," Marsh replied. "I'm going to be taking your paper, if you don't mind."
"Go ahead," Jeffers said. "I'd finished."
Back at the bar, Marsh reread the story about the woodyard man. Why should Joshua York be cutting out some item about some fool trash killed by wolves? Marsh couldn't figure an answer, but it bothered him. He looked up and noticed Simon's eyes on him in the big mirror over the bar. Marsh quickly folded up the Democrat again and stuffed it into a pocket.
"Let me have a little glass of whiskey," he said.
Marsh drank the whiskey straight down and made a long "ah" as the burning spread down through his chest. It cleared his head a mite. There were ways he could find out more about this, but then again it wasn't rightly his business what kind of newspaper stories Joshua York liked to read. Besides, he had given his word not to go prying into York's business, and Abner Marsh fancied himself a man of his word. Resolute, Marsh set down his glass and moved away from the bar. He clumped down the grand, curving stair to the main deck and tossed both newspapers into one of the dark furnaces. The deckhands looked at him strangely, but Marsh felt better immediately. A man shouldn't go around entertaining suspicions about his partner, especially one as generous and well-mannered as Joshua York.
"What are you looking at?" he barked at the deckhands. "Ain't you got no work to do? I'll find Hairy Mike and see he gets you some."
Immediately the men were busy. Abner Marsh went back up to the main cabin and had himself another drink. The next morning, Marsh went over to Pine Street to his company's main office and tended to business for several hours. He lunched at the planter's house, surrounded by old friends and old rivals, feeling grand. Marsh bragged up a storm about his steamer and had to endure Farrell and O'Brien flapping their jaws about their boats, but that was all right. He just smiled and said,
"Well, boys, maybe we'll meet on the river. Wouldn't that be grand?"
Not a soul mentioned his previous misfortune, and three different men came up to his table and asked Marsh if he needed a pilot for the lower Mississippi. It was a fine couple of hours. Strolling back to the river, Marsh chanced to pass a tailor's shop. He hesitated, tugging at his beard thoughtfully while he mulled over an idea that had struck him real sudden. Then he went inside, grinning, and ordered up a new captain's coat for himself, a white one, with a double row of silver buttons just like Joshua's. Marsh left $2 on account and arranged to pick up the coat when the fevered dream returned to St. Louis. He left feeling very satisfied with himself. The riverfront was chaotic. A consignment of dry goods had arrived late, and the roustabouts were sweating to get it loaded up in time. Whitey had the steam up. Tall white plumes were rising from escape pipes, and dark smoke rolled out of the chimney's flowered tops. The steamer to the left of the Fever Dream was backing out, with great gouts of smoke and much whistle-blowing and shouting. And the big side-wheeler to the right was unloading freight onto its wharf boat, an old, decrepit shell of a steamer tied permanently to the landing. All up and down the riverfront there were steamboats. As far as the eye could see in either direction, more boats than Marsh could count. Nine boats up was the luxurious three-deck John Simons, taking on passengers. Down from her was the side-wheeler Northern Light, with a picture of the Aurora painted gaudy on her paddle boxes. She was a brand-new Upper Mississippi steamer, and the Northwestern line said she was faster than any boat that had plied those waters yet. Coming downriver was the Grey Eagle, which the Northern Light was going to have to take to live up to her brag. There was the Northerner, and the crude, powerful Stenwheeler St. Joe, and the Divern and the Second, and the Natchez. Marsh looked at each of them in turn, at the intricate devices suspended between their chimneys, at their fancy jigsaw carpentry and their bright paint, at their hissing, billowing steam, at the power in their wheels. And then he looked at his own boat, the Fevered Dream, all white and blue and silver, and it seemed to him that her steam rose higher than any of the others, and her whistle had a sweeter, clearer tone, and her paint was cleaner, and her wheels more formidable, and she stood taller than all but three or four of the other boats, and she was longer than just about any of them.
"We'll take 'em all," he said to himself, and he went on down to his lady.